hoisted the window and looked up the air shaft. Snow flew above the roof of the house. He looked downward and saw nothing but black darkness, into which now and then a few flakes of white floated from the sky, falling slowly in the dim glow of the flashlight. He lowered the window and turned back to Bessie. She had not moved. He crossed the floor and took the purse from her, and got the half-filled flask, and drained it. It was good. It burned in his stomach and took his mind off the cold and the sound of the wind outside. He sat on the edge of the pallet and lit a cigarette. It was the first one he had smoked in a long time. He sucked the hot smoke deep into his lungs and blew it out slowly. The whiskey heated him all over, making his head whirl. Bessie cried, softly, piteously. "Come on and lay down," he said. He took the gun from his coat pocket and put it where he could reach it. "Come on, Bessie. You'll freeze standing there like that." He stood up and pulled off his overcoat and spread it upon the top of the blanket for additional cover, then switched off the flashlight. The whiskey lulled him, numbed his senses. Bessie's soft whimpers came to him through the cold. He took a long last draw from the cigarette and crushed it. Bessie's shoes creaked over the floor. He lay quietly, feeling the warmth of the alcohol spreading through him. He was tense inside. It was as though he had been compelled to hold himself in a certain awkward posture for a long time, and then when he had the chance to relax, he could not. He was tense with desire, but as long as he knew that Bessie was standing there in the room, he kept it from his mind. Bessie was worried, and not to her should his mind turn now in that way. But that part of him, which always made him at least outwardly adjusted to what was expected of him, made him now keep what his body wanted out of full consciousness. He heard Bessie's clothes rustling in the darkness, and he knew that she was pulling off her coat. Soon she would be lying there beside him. He waited for her. After a few moments, he felt her fingers pass lightly over his face. She was seeking for the pallet. He reached out, groping, and found her arm. "Here, lay down." He held the cover for her. She slid down beside him and stretched out. Now that she was close to him, the whiskey made him whirl faster, and the tensity of his body mounted. A gust of wind rattled the window pane and made the old building creak. He felt snug and warm, even though he knew he was in danger. The building might fall upon him as he slept, but the police might get him if he were anywhere else. He laid his fingers upon Bessie's shoulders. Slowly, he felt the stiffness go out of her body, and as it left, the tensity of his own rose, and his blood grew hot. "Cold?" he asked in a soft whisper.
"Yeah,"
she breathed. "Get close to me."
"I never thought I'd be like this."
"It won't be like this always."
"I'd just as soon die right now."
"Don't say that."
"I'm cold all over. I feel like I'll never get warm."
He drew her closer till he felt her breath coming full in his face. The wind swept against the window pane and the building, whining, then whispered out into silence. He turned from his back and lay face to face with her, on his side. He kissed her. Her lips were cold. He kept kissing her until her lips grew warm and soft. A huge, warm pull of desire rose in him, insistent and demanding. He let his hand slide from her shoulder to her breasts, feeling one, then the other. He slipped his other arm beneath her head, kissing her again, hard and long.
"Please, bigger."
She tried to turn from him, but his arm held her tightly. She lay still, whimpering. He heard her sigh, a sigh he knew, for he had heard it many times before. But this time he heard in it a sigh deep down beneath the familiar one, a sigh of resignation, a giving up, a surrender of something more than her body. Her head lay limp in the crook of his arm, and his hand reached for the hem of her dress, caught it in his fingers, and gathered it up slowly. His cold fingers touched her warm flesh, and sought still warmer and softer flesh. Bessie was still, unresisting, without response. His icy fingers touched inside of her, and at once she spoke, not a word, but a sound that gave forth a meaning of horror accepted. Her breath went out of her lungs in long, soft gasps that turned to a whisper of pleading.
Bigger. Don't.
Her voice came to him now from out of a deep, faraway silence, and he paid her no heed. The loud demand of the tensity of his own body was a voice that drowned out hers. In the cold darkness of the room, it seemed that he was on some vast turning wheel that made him want to turn faster and faster. That in turning faster, he would get warmth and sleep and be rid of his tense fatigue. He was conscious of nothing now but her and what he wanted. He flung the cover back, ignoring the cold, and not knowing that he did it. Bessie's hands were on his chest, her fingers spreading protestingly open, pushing him away. He heard her give a soft moan that seemed not to end, even when she breathed in or out. A moan which he heard, too, from far away, and without heeding. He had to now. Yes, Bessie. His desire was naked and hot in his hand, and his fingers were touching her. Yes, Bessie. Now. He had to now.
Don't, Bigger. Don't.
He was sorry. But he had to. He could not help it. Help it. Sorry. Help it. Sorry. Help it. Sorry. Help it. Now. She should. Look. She should look. Look at how he was. He was. He was feeling bad about how she would feel, but he could not help it now. Feeling. Bessie. Now. All. He heard her breathing heavily, and heard his own breath going and coming heavily.
Bigger.
Now. All. All. Now. All.
Bigger.
He lay still, feeling rid of that hunger and tenseness, and hearing the wail of the night wind over and above his and her breathing. He turned from her, and lay on his back again, stretching his legs wide apart. He felt the tenseness flow gradually from him. His breathing grew less and less heavy and rapid until he could no longer hear it, then so slow and steady that the consciousness of breathing left him entirely. He was not at all sleepy, and he lay, feeling Bessie lying there beside him. He turned his head in the darkness toward her. Her breath came to him slowly. He wondered if she was sleeping. Somewhere deep in him, he knew that he was lying here, waiting for her to go to sleep. Bessie did not figure in what was before him. He remembered that he had seen two bricks lying on the floor of the room as he had entered. He tried to recall just where they were, but could not. But he was sure they were somewhere. He would have to find them. At least one of them. It would have been much better if he had not said anything to Bessie about the murder. Well, it was her own fault. She had bothered him so much that he had had to tell her. And how on earth could he have known that they would find Mary's bones in the furnace so soon? He felt no regret as the image of the smoking furnace and the white pieces of bone came back to him. He had gazed straight at those bones for almost a full minute and had not been able to realize that they were the bones of Mary's body. He had thought that they might find out some other way, and then suddenly confront him with the evidence. Never did he think that he could stand and look at the evidence and not know it. His thoughts came back to the room. What about Bessie? He listened to her breathing. He could not take her with him, and he could not leave her behind. Yes. She was asleep. He reconstructed in his mind the details of the room as he had seen them by the glow of the flashlight when he had first come in. The window was directly behind him, above his head. The flashlight was at his side. The gun was lying beside the flashlight, the handle pointing toward him, so he could get it quickly and be in a position to use it. But he could not use the gun. That would make too much noise. He would have to use a brick. He remembered hoisting the window. It had not been hard. Yes. That was what he could do with it. Throw it out of the window, down the narrow air shaft where nobody would find it until, perhaps, it had begun to smell. He could not leave her here, and he could not take her with him. If he took her along, she would be crying all the time. She would be blaming him for all that had happened. She would be wanting whiskey to help her to forget, and there would be times when he could not get it for her. The room was black, dark, and silent. The city did not exist. He sat up slowly, holding his breath, listening. Bessie's breath was deep, regular. He could not take her, and he could not leave her. He stretched out his hand and caught the flashlight. He listened again. Her breath came like the sleep of the tired. He was holding the covers off her by sitting up this way, and he did not want her to get cold and awaken. He eased the covers back. She still slept. His finger pressed a button on the flashlight, and a dim spot of yellow leaped to life on the opposite wall. Quickly he lowered it to the floor, for fear that it might disturb her. And as he did so, there passed before his eyes in a split second of time one of the bricks he had glimpsed when he had first come into the room. He stiffened. Bessie stirred restlessly. Her deep, regular breathing had stopped. He listened, but could not hear it. He saw her breath as a white thread stretching out over a vast black gulf, and felt that he was clinging to it, and was waiting to see if the ravel in the white thread, which had started, would continue, and let him drop to the rocks far below. Then he heard her breathing again. In, out. In, out. He, too, breathed again, struggling now with his own breath to control it, to keep it from sounding so loud in his throat that it would awaken her. The fear that had gripped him when she had stirred made him realize that it would have to be quick and sure. Softly, he poked his legs from beneath the blanket, then waited. Bessie breathed, slow, long, heavy, regular. He lifted his arm and the blanket fell away. He stood up and his muscles lifted his body in slow motion. Outside in the cold night, the wind moaned and died down, like an idiot in an icy black pit. Turning, he centered the disk of light where he thought Bessie's face must be. Yes, she was asleep. Her black face, stained with tears, was calm. He switched off the light, turned toward the wall, and his fingers felt over the cold floor for the brick. He found it, gripped it in his hand, and tiptoed back to the pallet. Her breath guided him in the darkness. He stopped where he thought her head must be. He couldn't take her, and he couldn't leave her. So he would have to kill her. It was his life against hers. Quickly, to make certain where he must strike, he switched on the light, fearing as he did so that it might awaken her, then switched it off again, retaining as an image before his eyes her black face calm in deep sleep. He straightened and lifted the brick, but just at that moment, the reality of it all slipped from him. His heart beat wildly, trying to force its way out of his chest. No, not this. His breath swelled deep in his lungs, and he flexed his muscles, trying to impose his will over his body. He had to do better than this. Then, as suddenly as the panic had come, it left. But he had to stand here until the picture came back. That motive. That driving desire to escape the law. Yes, it must be this way. A sense of the white blur hovering near, of Mary burning, of Britain, of the law tracking him down, came back. Again he was ready. The brick was in his hand. In his mind, his hand traced a quick, invisible arc through the cold air of the room. High above his head, his hand paused in fancy and imaginatively swooped down to where he thought her head must be. He was rigid, not moving. This was the way it had to be. Then he took a deep breath, and his hand gripped the brick and shot upward, and paused a second, and then plunged downward through the darkness to the accompaniment of a deep, short grunt from his chest, and landed with a thud. Yes. There was a dull gasp of surprise, then a moan. No, that must not be. He lifted the brick again and again, until, in falling, it struck a sodden mass that gave softly but stoutly to each landing blow. Soon, he seemed to be striking a wet wad of cotton, of some damp substance whose only life was the jarring of the brick's impact. He stopped, hearing his own breath heaving in and out of his chest. He was wet all over, and cold. How many times had he lifted the brick and brought it down, he did not know. All he knew was that the room was quiet and cold, and that the job was done. In his left hand, he still held the flashlight, gripping it for sheer life. He wanted to switch it on and see if he had really done it, but could not. His knees were slightly bent, like a runner's poised for a race. Fear was in him again. He strained his ears. Didn't he hear her breathing? He bent and listened. It was his own breathing he heard. He had been breathing so loud that he had not been able to tell if Bessie was still breathing or not. His fingers on the brick began to ache. He had been gripping it for some minutes with all the strength of his body. He was conscious of something warm and sticky on his hand, and his sense of it covered him, all over. It cast a warm glow that enveloped the surface of his skin. He wanted to drop the brick, wanted to be free of this warm blood that crept and grew powerful with each passing moment. Then a dreadful thought rendered him incapable of action. Suppose Bessie was not as she had sounded when the brick hit her. Suppose, when he turned on the flashlight, he would see her lying there staring at him, with those round, large black eyes, her bloody mouth open in awe and wonder and pain and accusation. A cold chill, colder than the air of the room, closed about his shoulders like a shawl, whose strands were woven of ice. It became unbearable, and something within him cried out in silent agony. He stooped until the brick touched the floor, then loosened his fingers, bringing his hand to his stomach where he wiped it dry upon his coat. Gradually his breath subsided until he could no longer hear it, and then he knew for certain that Bessie was not breathing. The room was filled with quiet and cold and death and blood and the deep moan of the night wind. But he had to look. He lifted the flashlight to where he thought her head must be and pressed the button. The yellow spot sprang wide and dim on an empty stretch of floor. He moved it over a circle of crumpled bedclothes. There. Blood and lips and hair and face turned to one side and blood running slowly. She seemed limp. He could act now. He turned off the light. Could he leave her here? No. Somebody might find her. Avoiding her, he stepped to the far side of the pallet, then turned in the dark. He centered the spot of light where he thought the window must be. He walked to the window and stopped, waiting to hear someone challenge his right to do what he was doing. Nothing happened. He caught hold of the window, hoisted it slowly up, and the wind blasted his face. He turned to Bessie again, and threw the light upon the face of death and blood. He put the flashlight in his pocket, and stepped carefully in the dark to her side. He would have to lift her in his arms. His arms hung loose and did not move. He just stood. But he had to move her. He had to get her to the window. He stooped and slid his hands beneath her body, expecting to touch blood, but not touching it. Then he lifted her, feeling the wind screaming a protest against him. He stepped to the window and lifted her into it. He was working fast now that he had started. He pushed her as far out in his arms as possible, then let go. The body hit and bumped against the narrow sides of the air shaft as it went down into blackness. He heard it strike the bottom. He turned the light upon the pallet, half expecting her to still be there, but there was only a pool of warm blood, a faint veil of vapor hovering in the air above it. Blood was on the pillows, too. He took them and threw them out of the window, down the air shaft. It was over. He eased the window down. He would take the pallet into another room. He wished he could leave it here, but it was cold, and he needed it. He rolled the quilts and blanket into a bundle and picked it up and went into the hall. Then he stopped abruptly, his mouth open.
Good God, goddamn!
Yes, it was in her dress pocket. Now he was in for it. He had thrown Bessie down the air shaft and the money was in the pocket of her dress. What could he do about it? Should he go down and get it? Anguish gripped him.
No.
He did not want to see her again. He felt that if he should ever see her face again, he would be overcome with a sense of guilt so deep as to be unbearable. That was a dumb thing to do, he thought. Throwing her away with all that money in her pocket. He sighed, and went through the hall and entered another room. Well, he would have to do without money. That was all. He spread the quilts upon the floor and rolled himself into them. He had 7 cents between him and starvation and the law and the long days ahead. He closed his eyes, longing for a sleep that would not come. During the last 2 days and nights, he had lived so fast and hard that it was an effort to keep it all real in his mind. So close had danger and death come that he could not feel that it was he who had undergone it all. And yet, out of it all, over and above all that had happened, impalpable but real, there remained to him a queer sense of power. He had done this. He had brought all this about. In all of his life, these 2 murders were the most meaningful things that had ever happened to him. He was living truly and deeply, no matter what others might think, looking at him with their blind eyes. Never had he had the chance to live out the consequences of his actions. Never had his will been so free as in this night and day of fear and murder and flight. He had killed 2 times, but in a true sense it was not the first time he had ever killed. He had killed many times before, but only during the last 2 days had this impulse assumed the form of actual killing. Blind anger had come often, and he had either gone behind his curtain or wall, or had quarreled and fought. And yet, whether in running away or in fighting, he had felt the need of the clean satisfaction of facing this thing in all its fullness. Of fighting it out in the wind and sunlight, in front of those whose hate for him was so unfathomably deep that after they had shunted him off in a corner of the city to rot and die, they could turn to him, as Mary had that night in the car, and say, "I'd like to know how your people live." But what was he after? What did he want? What did he love? And what did he hate? He did not know. There was something he knew and something he felt. Something the world gave him, and something he himself had. Something spread out in front of him, and something spread out in back. And never in all his life, with this black skin of his, had the two worlds, thought and feeling, will and mind, aspiration and satisfaction, been together. Never had he felt a sense of wholeness. Sometimes in his room or on the sidewalk, the world seemed to him a strange labyrinth, even when the streets were straight and the walls were square. A chaos, which made him feel that something in him should be able to understand it, divide it, focus it. But only under the stress of hate was the conflict resolved. He had been so conditioned in a cramped environment that hard words or kicks alone knocked him upright and made him capable of action. Action that was futile because the world was too much for him. It was then that he closed his eyes and struck out blindly, hitting what or whom he could, not looking or caring what or who hit back. And under it all, and this made it hard for him, he did not want to make believe that it was solved, make believe that he was happy when he was not. He hated his mother for that way of hers, which was like Bessie's. What his mother had was Bessie's whiskey, and Bessie's whiskey was his mother's religion. He did not want to sit on a bench and sing, or lie in a corner and sleep. It was when he read the newspapers or magazines, went to the movies, or walked along the streets with crowds, that he felt what he wanted, to merge himself with others, to be a part of this world, to lose himself in it so he could find himself, to be allowed a chance to live like others, even though he was black. He turned restlessly on his hard pallet and groaned. He had been caught up in a whirl of thought and feeling which had swept him onward, and when he opened his eyes, he saw that daylight stood outside of a dirty window just above his head. He jumped up and looked out. The snow had stopped falling, and the city, white, still, was a vast stretch of rooftops and sky. He had been thinking about it for hours here in the dark, and now there it was, all white, still. But what he had thought about it had made it real with a reality it did not have now in the daylight. When lying in the dark thinking of it, it seemed to have something which left it when it was looked at. Why should not this cold, white world rise up as a beautiful dream in which he could walk and be at home, in which it would be easy to tell what to do and what not to do? If only someone had gone before and lived or suffered or died, made it so that it could be understood. It was too stark, not redeemed, not made real with the reality that was the warm blood of life. He felt that there was something missing, some road which, if he had once found it, would have led him to a sure and quiet knowledge. But why think of that now? A chance for that was gone forever. He had committed murder, twice, and had created a new world for himself.
This ends Disc 8, Native Son, Disc 9.
He left the room and went down to a window on the first floor and looked out. The street was quiet and no cars were running. The tracks were buried under snow. No doubt the blizzard had tied up traffic all over the city. He saw a little girl pick her way through the snow and stop at a corner newsstand. A man hurried out of a drugstore and sold the girl a paper. Could he snatch a paper while the man was inside? The snow was so soft and deep, he might get caught trying to get away. Could he find an empty building in which to hide after he had snatched the paper? Yes, that was just the thing. He looked carefully up and down the street. No one was in sight. He went through the door, and the wind was like a branding iron on his face. The sun came out suddenly, so strong and full that it made him dodge as from a blow. A million bits of sparkle pained his eyes. He went to the newsstand and saw a tall black headline. Hunt Black in Girl's Death. Yes, they had the story. He walked on and looked for a place to hide after he had snatched the paper. At the corner of an alley, he saw an empty building with a gaping window on the first floor. Yes, this was a good place. He mapped out a careful plan of action. He did not want it said that he had done all the things he had and then had got caught stealing a 3-cent newspaper. He went to the drugstore and looked inside at the man leaning against a wall, smoking. Yes, like this. He reached out and grabbed a paper, and in the act of grabbing it, he turned and looked at the man who was looking at him, a cigarette slanting whitely across his black chin. Even before he moved from his tracks, he ran. He felt his legs turn, start, then slip in snow. God damn. The white world tilted at a sharp angle, and the icy wind shot past his face. He fell flat and the crumbs of snow ate coldly at his fingers. He got up, on one knee, then on both. When he was on his feet, he turned toward the drugstore, still clutching the paper, amazed and angry with himself for having been so clumsy. The drugstore door opened. He ran. Hey! As he ducked down the alley, he saw the man standing in the snow looking at him, and he knew that the man would not follow. Hey, you! He scrambled to the window, pitched the paper in before him, caught hold and heaved himself upward onto the ledge, and then inside. He landed on his feet and stood peering through the window into the alley. All was white and quiet. He picked up the paper and walked down the hallway to the steps and up to the third floor, using the flashlight and hearing his footsteps echo faintly in the empty building. He stopped, clutched his pocket in panic as his mouth flew open. Yes, he had it. He thought that he had dropped the gun when he had fallen in the snow, but it was still there. He sat on the top step of the stairs and opened out the paper, but for quite a while he did not read. He listened to the creaking of the building caused by the wind sweeping over the city. Yes, he was alone. He looked down and read, "Reporters find Dalton girl's bones in furnace. Negro chauffeur disappears. 5,000 police surround black belt. Authorities hint sex crime. Communist leader proves alibi. Girl's mother in collapse." He paused and reread the line. "Authorities hint sex crime." Those words excluded him utterly from the world. To hint that he had committed a sex crime was to pronounce the death sentence. It meant a wiping out of his life, even before he was captured. It meant death before death came, for the white men who read those words would at once kill him in their hearts. The Mary Dalton kidnapping case was dramatically cracked wide open when a group of local newspaper reporters accidentally discovered several bones, later positively established as those of the missing heiress, in the furnace of the Dalton home late today. Search of the Negro's home, 3721 Indiana Avenue, in the heart of the South Side, failed to reveal his whereabouts. Police expressed belief that Miss Dalton met her death at the hands of the Negro, perhaps in a sex crime, and that the white girl's body was burned to destroy evidence. Bigger looked up. His right hand twitched. He wanted a gun in that hand. He got his gun from his pocket and held it. He read again. Immediately, a cordon of 5,000 police, augmented by more than 3,000 volunteers, was thrown about the Black Belt. Chief of Police Glenman said this morning that he believed that the Negro was still in the city, since all roads leading in and out of Chicago were blocked by a record-breaking snowfall. Indignation rose to white heat last night as the news of the Negro's rape and murder of the missing heiress spread through the city. Police reported that many windows in the Negro sections were smashed. Every streetcar, bus, L train, and auto leaving the South Side is being stopped and searched. police and vigilantes, armed with rifles, tear gas, flashlights, and photos of the killer, began at 18th Street this morning and are searching every Negro home under a blanket warrant from the mayor. They are making a careful search of all abandoned buildings, which are said to be hideouts for Negro criminals. Maintaining that they feared for the lives of their children, a delegation of white parents called upon Superintendent of City Schools Horace Minton and begged that all schools be closed until the Negro rapist and murderer was captured. Reports were current that several Negro men were beaten in various North and West Side neighborhoods. In the Hyde Park and Englewood districts, men organized vigilante groups and sent word to Chief of Police Glenman offering aid. Glenman said this morning that the aid of such groups would be accepted. He stated that a woefully undermanned police force, together with recurring waves of Negro crime, made such a procedure necessary. Several hundred Negroes resembling Bigger Thomas were rounded up from Southside hotspots. They are being held for investigation. In a radio broadcast last night, Mayor Ditz warned of possible mob violence and exhorted the public to maintain order. "Every effort is being made to apprehend this fiend," he said. It was reported that several hundred Negro employees throughout the city had been dismissed from jobs. A well-known banker's wife phoned this paper that she had dismissed her Negro cook for fear that she might poison the children. Bigger's eyes were wide and his lips were parted. He scanned the print quickly. Handwriting experts busy. Erlone's fingerprints not found in Dalton home. Radical still in custody. And then a sentence leaped at Bigger like a blow. Police are not yet satisfied with the account Erlone has given of himself and are of the conviction that he may be linked to the Negro as an accomplice. They feel that the plan of the murder and kidnapping was too elaborate to be the work of a Negro mind. At that moment, he wanted to walk out into the street and up to a policeman and say, "No, Jan didn't help me. He didn't have a damn thing to do with it. I did it." His lips twisted in a smile that was half leer and half defiance. Holding the paper in taut fingers, he read phrases. "Negro ordered to clean out ashes. Reluctant to respond. Dreading discovery. Smoke-filled basement. Tragedy of communism and racial mixture. Possibility that kidnap note was work of Reds." Bigger looked up. The building was quiet, save for the continual creaking caused by the wind. He could not stay here. There was no telling when they were coming into this neighborhood. He could not leave Chicago. All roads were blocked, and all trains, buses, and autos were being stopped and searched. It would have been much better if he had tried to leave town at once. He should have gone to some other place, perhaps Gary, Indiana, or Evanston. He looked at the paper and saw a black-and-white map of the South Side, around the borders of which was a shaded portion an inch deep. Under the map ran a line of small print. "Shaded portion shows area already covered by police and vigilantes in search for Negro rapist and murderer. White portion shows area yet to be searched." He was trapped. He would have to get out of this building. But where could he go? Empty buildings would serve only as long as he stayed within the white portion of the map, and the white portion was shrinking rapidly. He remembered that the paper had been printed last night. That meant that the white portion was now much smaller than was shown here. He closed his eyes, calculating. He was at 53rd Street, and the hunt had started last night at 18th Street. If they had gone from 18th Street to 28th Street last night, then they would have gone from 28th Street to 38th Street since then. And by midnight tonight, they would be at 48th Street, or right here. He wondered about empty flats. The paper had not mentioned them. Suppose he found a small, empty kitchenette flat in a building where many people lived. That was by far the safest thing. He went to the end of the hall and flashed the light on a dirty ceiling and saw a wooden stairway leading to the roof. He climbed and pulled himself up into a narrow passage at the end of which was a door. He kicked at the door several times, each kick making it give slightly until he saw snow, sunshine, and an oblong strip of sky. The wind came stinging into his face, and he remembered how weak and cold he was. How long could he keep going this way? He squeezed through and stood in the snow on the roof. Before him was a maze of white, sun-drenched rooftops. He crouched behind a chimney and looked down into the street. At the corner he saw the newsstand from which he had stolen the paper. The man who had shouted at him was standing by it. Two black men stopped at the newsstand and bought a paper, then walked into a doorway. One of them leaned eagerly over the other's shoulder. Their lips moved and they pointed their black fingers at the paper and shook their heads as they talked. Two more men joined them, and soon there was a small knot of them standing in the doorway, talking and pointing at the paper. They broke up abruptly and went away. Yes, they were talking about him. Maybe all of the black men and women were talking about him this morning. Maybe they were hating him for having brought this attack upon them. He had crouched so long in the snow that when he tried to move, he found that his legs had lost all feeling. A fear that he was freezing seized him. He kicked out his legs to restore circulation of his blood, then crawled to the other side of the roof. Directly below him, one floor away, through a window without shades, he saw a room in which were two small iron beds with sheets, dirty and crumpled. In one bed sat three naked black children looking across the room to the other bed, on which lay a man and a woman, both naked and black in the sunlight. There were quick, jerky movements on the bed where the man and woman lay, and the three children were watching. It was familiar. He had seen things like that when he was a little boy, sleeping five in a room. Many mornings he had awakened and watched his father and mother. He turned away, thinking, five of them sleeping in one room, and here's a great big empty building with just me in it. He crawled back to the chimney, seeing before his eyes an image of the room of five people, all of them blackly naked in the strong sunlight, seen through a sweaty pane, the man and woman moving jerkily in tight embrace, and the three children watching. Hunger came to his stomach. An icy hand reached down his throat and clutched his intestines and tied them into a cold, tight knot that ached. The memory of the bottle of milk Bessie had heated for him last night came back so strongly that he could almost taste it. If he had that bottle of milk now, he would make a fire out of a newspaper and hold the bottle over the flame until it was warm. He saw himself take the top off the white bottle, with some of the warm milk spilling over his black fingers, and then lift the bottle to his mouth and tilt his head and drink. His stomach did a slow flip-flop, and he heard it growl. He felt in his hunger a deep sense of duty, as powerful as the urge to breathe, as intimate as the beat of his heart. He felt like dropping to his knees and lifting his face to the sky and saying, I'm hungry. He wanted to pull off his clothes and roll in the snow until something nourishing seeped into his body through the pores of his skin. He wanted to grip something in his hand so hard that it would turn to food. But soon, his hunger left. Soon he was taking it a little easier. Soon his mind rose from the desperate call of his body and concerned itself with the danger that lurked about him. He felt something hard at the corners of his lips and touched it with his fingers. It was frozen saliva. He crawled back through the door into the narrow passage and lowered himself down the shallow wooden steps into the hallway. He went to the first floor and stood at the window through which he had first climbed. He had to find an empty apartment in some building where he could get warm. He felt that if he did not get warm soon, he would simply lie down and close his eyes. Then he had an idea. He wondered why he had not thought of it before. He struck a match and lit the newspaper. As it blazed, he held one hand over it a while, and then the other. The heat came to his skin from far off. When the paper had burned so close that he could no longer hold it, he dropped it to the floor and stamped it out with his shoes. At least he could feel his hands now. At least they ached and let him know that they were his. He climbed through the window and walked to the street, turned northward, joining the people passing. No one recognized him. He looked for a building with a for rent sign. He walked two blocks and saw none. He knew that empty flats were scarce in the Black Belt. Whenever his mother wanted to move, she had to put in requests long months in advance. He remembered that his mother had once made him tramp the streets for 2 whole months looking for a place to live. The rental agencies had told him that there were not enough houses for Negroes to live in, that the city was condemning houses in which Negroes lived as being too old and too dangerous for habitation. And he remembered the time when the police had come and driven him and his mother and his brother and sister out of a flat in a building which had collapsed 2 days after they had moved. And he had heard it said that black people, even though they could not get good jobs, paid twice as much rent as whites for the same kind of flats. He walked 5 more blocks and saw no for rent sign. God damn. Would he freeze trying to find a place in which to get warm? How easy it would be for him to hide if he had the whole city in which to move about. They keep us bottled up here like wild animals, he thought. He knew that black people could not go outside of the Black Belt to rent a flat. They had to live on their side of the line. No white real estate man would rent a flat to a black man, other than in the sections where it had been decided that black people might live. His fists clenched. What was the use of running away? He ought to stop right here in the middle of the sidewalk and shout out what this was. It was so wrong that surely all the black people round him would do something about it. So wrong that all the white people would stop and listen. But he knew that they would simply grab him and say that he was crazy. He reeled through the streets, his bloodshot eyes looking for a place to hide. He paused at a corner and saw a big black rat leaping over the snow. It shot past him into a doorway where it slid out of sight through a hole. He looked wistfully at the gaping black hole through which the rat had darted to safety. He passed a bakery and wanted to go in and buy some rolls with the 7 cents he had. But the bakery was empty of customers, and he was afraid that the white proprietor would recognize him. He would wait until he came to a Negro business establishment, but he knew that there were not many of them. Almost all businesses in the Black Belt were owned by Jews, Italians, and Greeks. Most Negro businesses were funeral parlors. White undertakers refused to bother with dead black bodies. He came to a chain grocery store. Bread sold here for 5 cents a loaf, but across the line, where white folks lived, it sold for 4. And now, of all times, he could not cross that line. He stood looking through the plate glass at the people inside. Ought he to go in? He had to. He was starving. They trick us every breath we draw, he thought. They gouge our eyes out. He opened the door and walked to the counter. The warm air made him dizzy. He caught hold of a counter in front of him and steadied himself. His eyes blurred, and there swam before him a vast array of red and blue and green and yellow cans stacked high upon shelves. All about him, he heard the soft voices of men and women. You waited on, sir? A loaf of bread, he whispered. Anything else, sir? No. The man's face went away and came again. He heard paper rustling. Cold out, isn't it? Huh? Oh, yes, sir. He laid the nickel on the counter. He saw the blurred loaf being handed to him. Thank you. Call again. He walked unsteadily to the door with the loaf under his arm. Oh, Lord. If only he could get into the street. In the doorway, he met people coming in. He stood to one side to let them pass, then went into the cold wind, looking for an empty flat. At any moment, he expected to hear his name shouted, expected to feel his arms being grabbed. He walked 5 blocks before he saw a 2-story flat building with a for rent sign in a window. Smoke bulged out of chimneys, and he knew that it was warm inside. He went to the front door and read the little vacancy notice pasted on the glass and saw that the flat was a rear one. He went down the alley to the rear steps and mounted to the second floor. He tried a window, and it slid up easily. He was in luck. He hoisted himself through and dropped into a warm room, a kitchen. He was suddenly tense, listening. He heard voices. They seemed to be coming from the room in front of him. Had he made a mistake? No. The kitchen was not furnished. No one, it seemed, lived in here. He tiptoed to the next room and found it empty. But he heard the voices even more clearly now. He saw still another room leading farther. He tiptoed and looked. That room, too, was empty, but the sound of the voices was coming so loud that he could make out the words. An argument was going on in the front flat. He stood with the loaf of bread in his hands, his legs wide apart, listening. "Jack, you mean to stand there and say you'd give the nigger up to the white folks?" "Damn right I would." "But Jack, suppose he ain't guilty. What in hell he run off for then? Maybe he thought they was gonna blame the murder on him. Listen, Jim, if he wasn't guilty, then he ought to stayed and faced it. If I knowed where the nigger was, I'd turn him up and get these white folks off me. But Jack, every nigger looks guilty to white folks when somebody's done a crime." "Yeah, that's 'cause so many of us act like Bigger Thomas, that's all. When you act like Bigger Thomas, you stir up trouble." "But Jack, who's stirring up trouble now? The papers say they beating us up all over the city. They don't care what black man they get. We's all dogs in they sight. You gotta stand up and fight these folks." "And get killed? Hell no. I got a family. I got a wife and baby. I ain't starting no fool fight. You can't get no justice protecting men who kill. We's all murderers to them, I tell you. Listen, Jim, I'm a hard-working man. I fixes the streets with a pick and shovel every day when I get a chance. But the boss told me he didn't want me in them streets with this mob feeling among the white folks. He says I'll get killed, so he lays me off. You see, that goddamn nigger Bigger Thomas made me lose my job. He made the white folks think we's all just like him. But Jack, I tell you, they think it already. You's a good man, but that ain't gonna keep him from coming to your home, is it? Hell no. We's all black, and we just as well act black, don't you see? Aw, Jim, it's all right to get mad, but you gotta look at things straight. The guy made me lose my job. That ain't fair. How was I gonna eat? If I knowed where the black son of a bitch was, I'd call the cops and let him come and get him. Well, I wouldn't. I'd die first. Man, you're crazy. Don't you want a home and wife and chillin'? What's fighting gonna get you? There's more of them than us. They could kill us all. You gotta learn to live and get along with people. When folks hate me, I don't want to get along. But we gotta eat. We gotta live. I don't care. I die first. Oh, hell, you're crazy. I don't care what you say. I die before I'd let them scare me into telling on that man. I tell you, I die first. He tiptoed back to the kitchen and took out his gun. He would stay here, and if his own people bothered him, he would use it. He turned on the water faucet and put his mouth under the stream, and the water exploded in his stomach. He sank to his knees and rolled in agony. Soon the pain ceased, and he drank again. Then slowly, so that the paper would not rustle, he unwrapped the loaf of bread and chewed a piece. It tasted good, like cake, with a sweetish and smooth flavor he had never thought bread could have. As he ate, his hunger returned in full force, and he sat on the floor and held a fistful of bread in each hand, his cheeks bulging and his jaws working, and his Adam's apple going up and down with each swallow. He could not stop until his mouth became so dry that the bread balled on his tongue. He held it there, savoring the taste. He stretched out on the floor and sighed. He was drowsy, but when he was on the verge of sleep, he jerked abruptly to a dull wakefulness. Finally, he slept, then sat up, half awake, following an unconscious prompting of fear. He groaned, and his hands flayed the air to ward off an invisible danger. Once he got up completely and walked a few steps with outstretched hands, and then lay down in a spot almost 10 feet from where he had originally slept. There were two biggers. One was determined to get rest and sleep at any cost, and the other shrank from images charged with terror. There came a long space of time in which he did not move. He lay on his back, his hands folded upon his chest, his mouth and eyes open. His chest rose and fell so slowly and gently that it seemed that during the intervals when it did not move, he would never breathe again. A wan sun came onto his face, making the black skin shine like dull metal. The sun left, and the quiet room filled with deep shadows. As he slept, there stole into his consciousness a disturbing, rhythmic throbbing, which he tried to fight off to keep from waking up. His mind, protecting him, wove the throb into patterns of innocent images. He thought he was in the Paris Grill, listening to the automatic phonograph playing, but that was not satisfying. Next, his mind told him that he was at home in bed, and his mother was singing and shaking the mattress, wanting him to get up. But this image, like the others, failed to quiet him. The throb pulsed on, insistent, and he saw hundreds of black men and women beating drums with their fingers. But that, too, did not answer the question. He tossed restlessly on the floor, then sprang to his feet, his heart pounding, his ears filled with the sound of singing and shouting. He went to the window and looked out. In front of him, down a few feet, through a window, was a dim-lit church. In it a crowd of black men and women stood between long rows of wooden benches, singing, clapping hands, and rolling their heads. "All them folks go to church every day in the week," he thought. He licked his lips and got another drink of water. How near were the police? What time was it? He looked at his watch and found that it had stopped running. He had forgotten to wind it. The singing from the church vibrated through him, suffusing him with a mood of sensitive sorrow. He tried not to listen, but it seeped into his feelings, whispering of another way of life and death, coaxing him to lie down and sleep, and let them come and get him, urging him to believe that all life was a sorrow that had to be accepted. He shook his head, trying to rid himself of the music. How long had he slept? What were the papers saying now? He had 2 cents left. That would buy times. He picked up what remained of the loaf of bread, and the music sang of surrender, resignation. "Steal away, steal away, steal away to Jesus." He stuffed the bread into his pockets. He would eat it sometime later. He made sure that his gun was still intact, hearing, steal away home, I ain't got long to stay here." It was dangerous to stay here, but it was also dangerous to go out. The singing filled his ears. It was complete, self-contained, and it mocked his fear and loneliness, his deep yearning for a sense of wholeness. Its fullness contrasted so sharply with his hunger, its richness with his emptiness, that he recoiled from it while answering it. Would it not have been better for him had he lived in that world the music sang of? It would have been easy to have lived in it, for it was his mother's world, humble, contrite, believing. It had a center, a core, an axis, a heart which he needed, but could never have unless he laid his head upon a pillow of humility and gave up his hope of living in the world. And he would never do that. He heard a streetcar passing in the street. They were running again. A wild thought surged through him. Suppose the police had already searched this neighborhood and had overlooked him. But sober judgment told him that that was impossible. He patted his pocket to make sure the gun was there, then climbed through the window. Cold wind smote his face. It must be below zero, he thought. At both ends of the alley, the street lamps glowed through the murky air, refracted into mammoth balls of light. The sky was dark blue and far away. He walked to the end of the alley and turned onto the sidewalk, joining the passing stream of people. He waited for someone to challenge his right to walk there, but no one did. At the end of the block, he saw a crowd of people, and fear clutched hard at his stomach. What were they doing? He slowed and saw that they were gathered about a newsstand. They were black people, and they were buying papers to read about how the white folks were trying to track him to Earth. He lowered his head and went forward and slipped into the crowd. The people were talking excitedly. Cautiously, he held out 2 cents in his cold fingers. When he was close enough, he saw the front page. His picture was in the center of it. He bent his head lower, hoping that no one would see him closely enough to see that it was he who was pictured there. Times, he said. He tucked the paper under his arm, edged out of the crowd, and walked southward, looking for an empty flat. At the next corner, he saw a for rent sign in a building which he knew was cut up into small kitchenette flats. That was what he wanted. He went to the door and read the sign. There was an empty flat on the 4th floor. He walked to the alley and began to mount the outside rear stairs, his feet softly crunching in snow. He heard a door open. He stopped, got his gun and waited, kneeling in the snow.
Who's that?
It was a woman's voice. Then a man's voice sounded.
What's the matter, Ellen? I thought I heard someone out here on the porch. Oh, you're simply nervous. You're scared of all this stuff you've been reading in the papers. But I'm sure I heard somebody. Oh, empty the garbage and shut the door. It's cold.
Bigger flattened against the building in the dark. He saw a woman come out of a door, pause, look round. She went to the far end of the porch and dumped something into a garbage pail, and went back inside. I would have had to kill them both if she saw me, he thought. He tiptoed up to the 4th floor and found 2 windows, both of them dark. He tried to lift the screen in one of them and found it frozen. Gently, he shook it to and fro until it loosened. Then he lifted it out and laid it on the porch in the snow. Inch by inch, he raised the window, breathing so loud that he thought surely people must hear him even in the streets. He climbed through into a dark room and struck a match. An electric light was on the other side of the room, and he went to it and pulled the chain. He put his cap over the bulb so that no light would seep through to the outside, then opened the paper. Yes. Here was a large picture of him. At the top of the picture ran a tall line of black type. 24-hour search fails to unearth rapist. In another column he saw, Raid 1,000 Negro homes. Incipient riot quelled at 47th and Halsted. There was another map of the South Side. This time, the shaded area had deepened from both the north and south, leaving a small square of white in the middle of the oblong black belt. He stood looking at that tiny square of white, as though gazing down into the barrel of a gun. He was there on that map, in that white spot, standing in a room waiting for them to come. Dead set, his eyes stared above the top of the paper. There was nothing left for him but to shoot it out. He examined the map again. The police had come from the north, as far south as 40th Street, and they had come from the south, as far north as 50th Street. That meant that he was somewhere in between, and they were minutes away. He read, "Today and last night, 8,000 armed men combed cellars, old buildings, and more than 1,000 Negro homes in the Black Belt, in a vain effort to apprehend Bigger Thomas, 20-year-old Negro rapist and killer of Mary Dalton, whose bones were found last Sunday night in a furnace." Bigger's eyes went down the page, snatching at what he thought most important. Word spread that the slayer had been captured, but was immediately denied. "Before night, police and vigilantes will have covered the entire Black Belt, raiding numerous communist headquarters throughout the city. The arrest of hundreds of Reds failed, however, to uncover any clues. Public warned by mayor against boring from within." Then, "A curious sidelight was revealed today when it became known that the apartment building in which the Negro killer lived is owned and managed by a sub-firm of the Dalton Real Estate Company." He lowered the paper. He could read no more. The one fact to remember was that 8,000 men, white men, with guns and gas, were out there in the night looking for him. According to this paper, they were but a few blocks away. Could he get to the roof of this building? If so, maybe he could crouch there until they passed. He thought of burying himself deep in the snow of the roof, but he knew that that was impossible. He pulled the chain again and plunged the room in darkness. Using the flashlight, he went to the door and opened it and looked into the hall. It was empty, and a dim light burned at the far end. He put out the flashlight and tiptoed, looking at the ceiling, searching for a trap door leading to the roof. Finally, he saw a pair of wooden steps leading upward. Suddenly, his muscles stiffened, as though a wire strung through his body had jerked him. A siren shriek entered the hallway, and immediately he heard voices, excited, low, tense. From somewhere down below, a man called, "They is coming!" There was nothing to do now but go up. He clutched the wooden steps above him and climbed, wanting to get out of sight before anyone came into the hall. He reached the trap door and pushed against it with his head. It opened. He grabbed something solid in the darkness above him and hoisted himself upward, hoping as he did so that it would hold him and not let him go crashing down upon the hall floor. He rested on his knees, his chest heaving. Then he eased the door shut, peering just in time to see a door in the hall opening. That was close. The siren sounded again. It was outside in the street. It seemed to sound a warning that no one could hide from it, that action to escape was futile, that soon the men with guns and gas would come and penetrate where the siren sound had penetrated. He listened. There were throbs of motors. Shouts rose from the streets. There were screams of women and curses of men. He heard footsteps on the stairs. The siren died and began again, on a high, shrill note this time. It made him want to clutch at his throat. As long as it sounded, it seemed that he could not breathe. He had to get to the roof. He switched on the flashlight and crawled through a narrow loft till he came to an opening. He put his shoulder to it and heaved. It gave so suddenly and easily that he drew back in fear. He thought that someone had snatched it open from above, and in the same instant of its opening, he saw an expanse of gleaming white snow against the dark smudge of night and a stretch of luminous sky. A medley of crashing sounds came, louder than he had thought that sound could be, horns, sirens, screams. There was hunger in those sounds as they crashed over the rooftops and chimneys. But under it, low and distinct, he heard voices of fear, curses of men, and cries of children. Yes, they were looking for him. In every building and on every floor and in every room, they wanted him. His eyes jerked upward as a huge, sharp beam of yellow light shot into the sky. Another came, crossing it like a knife. Then another. Soon the sky was full of them. They circled slowly, hemming him in, bars of light forming a prison. A wall between him and the rest of the world. Bars weaving a shifting wall of light into which he dared not go. He was in the midst of it now. This was what he had been running from. Ever since that night Mrs. Dalton had come into the room, and had charged him with such fear that his hands had gripped the pillow with fingers of steel and had cut off the air from Mary's lungs. Below him was a loud, heavy pounding, like a faraway rumble of thunder. He had to get to the roof. He struggled upward, then fell flat, in deep, soft snow, his eyes riveted upon a white man across the street upon another roof. Bigger watched the man whirl the beam of a flashlight. Would the man look in his direction? Could the beam of a flashlight make him visible from where the man was? He watched the man walk round a while, and then disappear. Quickly, he rose and shut the trap door. To leave it open would create suspicion. Then he fell flat again, listening. There was the sound of many running feet below him. It seemed that an army was thundering up the stairs. There was nowhere he could run to now. Either they caught him, or they did not. The thundering grew louder, and he knew that the men were nearing the top floor. He lifted his eyes and looked in all directions, watching roofs to the left and right of him. He did not want to be surprised by someone creeping upon him from behind. He saw that the roof to his right was not joined to the one upon which he lay. That meant that no one could steal upon him from that direction. The one to his left was joined to the roof of the building upon which he lay, making it one long icy runway. He lifted his head and looked. There were other roofs joined too. He could run over those roofs, over the snow and round those chimneys until he came to the building that dropped to the ground. Then that would be all. Would he jump off and kill himself? He did not know. He had an almost mystic feeling that if he were ever cornered, something in him would prompt him to act the right way, the right way being the way that would enable him to die without shame. He heard a noise close by. He looked round just in time to see a white face, a head, then shoulders pulled into view upon the roof to the right of him. A man stood up, cut sharply against the background of roving yellow lights. He watched the man twirl a pencil of light over the snow. Bigger raised his gun and trained it upon the man and waited. If the light reached him, he would shoot. What would he do afterwards? He did not know. But the yellow spot never reached him. He watched the man go down, feet first, then shoulders and head. He was gone. He relaxed a bit. At least the roof to his right was safe now. He waited to hear sounds that would tell him that someone was climbing up through the trapdoor. The rumbling below him rose in volume with the passing seconds, but he could not tell if the men were coming closer or receding. He waited and held his gun. Above his head, the sky stretched in a cold, dark blue oval, cupping the city like an iron palm covered with silk. The wind blew, hard, icy, without ceasing. It seemed to him that he had already frozen, that pieces could be broken off him as one chips bits from a cake of ice. In order to know that he still had the gun in his hand, he had to look at it, for his hand no longer had any feeling. Then he was stiff with fear. There were pounding feet right below him. They were on the top floor now. Ought he to run to the roof to his left? But he had seen no one search that roof. If he ran, he might come face to face with someone coming up out of another trapdoor. He looked round, thinking that maybe someone was creeping up on him, but there was nobody.